except to call the volunteer fire department during grass fire season in August and September. It was strictly for major disasters, and its sound was dreamy and terrifying in the empty house. She went to the window, but slowly. The shrieking of the whistle rose and fell. Somewhere, horns were beginning to blat, as if for a wedding. She could see her reflection in the darkened glass, lips parted, eyes wide, and then the condensation of her breath obscured it. A memory, half forgotten, came to her. As children in grammar school, they had practiced air raid drills. When the teacher clapped her hands and said, "The town whistle is blowing," you were supposed to crawl under your desk and put your hands over your head and wait, either for the all clear or for enemy missiles to blow you to powder. Now, in her mind, as clearly as a leaf pressed in plastic, "The town whistle is blowing." She heard the words clang in her mind. Far below, to the left, where the high school parking lot was, the ring of sodium arc lamps made it a sure landmark, although the school building itself was invisible in the dark. A spark glowed as if God had struck a flint and steel. "That's where the oil tanks are." The spark hesitated, then bloomed orange. Now you could see the school, and it was on fire. She was already on her way to the closet to get her coat when the first dull, booming explosion shook the floor under her feet and made her mother's china rattle in the cupboards. From We Survived the Black Prom by Norma Watson, published in the August 1980 issue of the Reader's Digest as a drama in real life article. And it happened so quickly that no one really knew what was happening. We were all standing and applauding and singing the school song. Then, I was at the usher's table just inside the main doors, looking at the stage. There was a sparkle as the big lights over the stage apron reflected on something metallic. I was standing with Tina Blake and Stella Horan, and I think they saw it too. All at once there was a huge red splash in the air. Some of it hit the mural and ran in long drips. I knew right away, even before it hit them, that it was blood. Stella Horan thought it was paint, but I had a premonition, just like the time my brother got hit by a hay truck. They were drenched. Carrie got it the worst. She looked exactly like she'd been dipped in a bucket of red paint. She just sat there. She never moved. The band that was closest to the stage, Josie and the Moonglows, got splattered. The lead guitarist had a white instrument, and it splattered all over it. I said, "My God, that's blood!" When I said that, Tina screamed. It was very loud, and it rang out clearly in the auditorium. People had stopped singing, and everything was completely quiet. I couldn't move. I was rooted to the spot. I looked up, and there were two buckets dangling high over the thrones, swinging and banging together. They were still dripping. All of a sudden, they fell, with a lot of loose string paying out behind them. One of them hit Tommy Ross on the head. It made a very loud noise, like a gong. That made someone laugh. I don't know who it was, but it wasn't the way a person laughs when they see something funny and gay. It was raw and hysterical and awful. At that same instant, Carrie opened her eyes wide. That was when they all started laughing. I did too. God help me. It was so weird. When I was a little girl, I had a Walt Disney storybook called Song of the South, and it had that Uncle Remus story about the tar baby in it. There was a picture of the tar baby sitting in the middle of the road, looking like one of those old-time Negro minstrels with the black face and great big white eyes. When Carrie opened her eyes, it was like that. They were the only part of her that wasn't completely red, and the light had gotten in them and made them glassy. God help me, but she looked for all the world like Eddie Cantor doing that pop-eyed act of his. That was what made people laugh. We couldn't help it. It was one of those things where you laugh or go crazy. Carrie had been the butt of every joke for so long, and we all felt that we were part of something special that night. It was as if we were watching a person rejoin the human race. And I, for one, thanked the Lord for it. And that happened. That horror. And so there was nothing else to do. It was either laugh or cry. And who could bring himself to cry over Carrie after all those years? She just sat there, staring out at them, and the laughter kept swelling, getting louder and louder. People were holding their bellies and doubling up and pointing at her. Tommy was the only one who wasn't looking at her. He was sort of slumped over in his seat as if he'd gone to sleep. You couldn't tell he was hurt, though. He was splashed too bad. And then her face broke. I don't know how else to describe it. She put her hands up to her face and half staggered to her feet. She almost got tangled in her own feet and fell over, and that made people laugh even more. Then she sort of hopped off the stage. It was like watching a big red frog hopping off a lily pad. She almost fell again, but kept on her feet. Miss Desjardins came running over to her, and she wasn't laughing anymore. She was holding out her arms to her. But then she veered off and hit the wall beside the stage. It was the strangest thing. She didn't stumble or anything. It was as if someone had pushed her. But there was no one there. Carrie ran through the crowd with her hands clutching her face, and somebody put his foot out. I don't know who it was, but she went sprawling on her face, leaving a long red streak on the floor. And she said, "Oof." I remember that. It made me laugh even harder hearing Carrie say "oof" like that. She started to crawl along the floor, and then she got up and ran out. She ran right past me. You could smell the blood. It smelled like something sick and rotted. She went down the stairs two at a time, and then out the doors, and was gone. The laughter just sort of faded off, a little at a time. Some people were still hitching and snorting. Lenny Brock had taken out a big white handkerchief and was wiping his eyes. Sally McManus looked all white, like she was going to throw up, but she was still giggling and she couldn't seem to stop. Billy Bosnam was just standing there with his little conductor stick in his hand and shaking his head. Mr. Lublin was sitting by Miss Desjardins and calling for a Kleenex. She had a bloody nose. You have to understand that all this happened in no more than 2 minutes. Nobody could put it all together. We were stunned. Some of them were wandering around, talking a little, but not much. Helen Shires burst into tears, and that made some of the others start up. Then someone yelled, "Call a doctor! Hey, call a doctor, quick!" It was Josie Vreck. He was up on the stage, kneeling by Tommy Ross, and his face was white as paper. He tried to pick him up, and the throne fell over, and Tommy rolled onto the floor. Nobody moved. They were all just staring. I felt like I was frozen in ice. "My God," was all I could think. "My God, my God, my God." And then this other thought crept in, and it was as if it wasn't my own at all. I was thinking about Carrie and about God. It was all twisted up together, and it was awful. Stella looked over at me and said, "Carrie's back." And I said, "Yes, that's right." The lobby doors all slammed shut. The sound was like hands clapping. Somebody in the back screamed, and that started the stampede. They ran for the doors in a rush. I just stood there not believing it. And when I looked, just before the first of them got there and started to push, I saw Carrie looking in, her face all smeared like an Indian with war paint on. She was smiling. They were pushing at the doors, hammering on them, but they wouldn't budge. As more of them crowded up against them, I could see the first ones to get there being battered against them, grunting and wheezing. They wouldn't open, and those doors are never locked. It's a state law. Mr. Stevens and Mr. Lublin waded in and began to pull them away, grabbing jackets, skirts, anything. They were all screaming and burrowing like cattle. Mr. Stevens slapped a couple of girls and punched Vic Mooney in the eye. They were yelling for them to go out the back fire doors. Some did. Those were the ones who lived. That's when it started to rain. At least that's what I thought it was at first. There was water falling all over the place. I looked up and all the sprinklers were on, all over the gym. Water was hitting the basketball court and splashing. Josie Freck was yelling for the guys in his band to turn off the electric amps and mics quick, but they were all gone. He jumped down from the stage. The panic at the door stopped. People backed away, looking up at the ceiling. I heard somebody, Don Farnham, I think, say, "This is going to wreck the basketball court." A few other people started to go over and look at Tommy Ross. All at once, I knew I wanted to get out of there. I took Tina Blake's hand and said, "Let's run, quick." To get to the fire doors, you had to go down a short corridor to the left of the stage. There were sprinklers there, too, but they weren't on, and the doors were open. I could see a few people running out, but most of them were just standing around in little groups, blinking at each other. Some of them were looking at the smear of blood where Carrie fell down. The water was washing it away. I took Tina's arm and started to pull her toward the exit sign. At the same instant, there was a huge flash of light, a scream, and a horrible feedback whine. I looked around and saw Joseph Freck holding onto one of the mic stands. He couldn't let go. His eyes were bugging out, and his hair was on end, and it looked like he was dancing. His feet were sliding around in the water, and smoke started to come out of his shirt. He fell over on one of the amps. They were big ones, 5 or 6 feet high, and it fell into the water. Feedback went up to a scream that was head-splitting, and then there was another sizzling flash, and it stopped. Josie's shirt was on fire. "Run," Tina yelled at me. "Come on, Norma, please." We ran out into the hallway, and something exploded backstage. The main power switches, I guess. For just a second, I looked back. You could see right out onto the stage where Tommy's body was because the curtain was up. All the heavy light cables were in the air, flowing and jerking and writhing like snakes out of an Indian fakir's basket. Then one of them pulled in two. It was a violent flash when it hit the water, and then everybody was screaming at once. Then we were out the door and running across the parking lot. I think I was screaming. I don't remember very well. I don't remember anything very well after they started screaming, after those high-voltage cables hit that water-covered floor. For Tommy Ross, age 18, the end came swiftly and mercifully and almost without pain. He was never even aware that something of importance was happening. There was a clanging, clashing noise that he associated momentarily with, "There go the milk buckets." A childhood memory of his Uncle Galen's farm, and then with "somebody dropped something," the band below him. He caught a glimpse of Josie Vreck looking over his head. "What, have I got a halo or something?" And then the quarter-full bucket of blood struck him. The raised lip along the bottom of the rim struck him on top of the head, and, "Hey, that her!" He went swiftly down into unconsciousness. He was still sprawled on the stage when the fire, originating in the electrical equipment of Josie and the Moonglows, spread to the mural of the Venetian boatman, and then to the rat warren of old uniforms, books, and papers backstage and overhead. He was dead when the oil tank exploded a half hour later. From the New England AP ticker, 10:46 p.m., Chamberlain, Maine, AP, "A fire is raging out of control at UN Consolidated High School at this time. A school dance was in progress at the time of the outbreak, which is believed to have been electrical in origin. Witnesses say that the school's sprinkler system went on without warning, causing a short circuit in the equipment of a rock band. Some witnesses also report breaks in main power cables. It is believed that as many as 110 persons may be trapped in the blazing school gymnasium. Firefighting equipment from the neighboring towns of Westover, Motton, and Lewiston have reportedly received requests for assistance and are now or shortly will be en route. As yet, no casualties have been reported. Ends. 10:46 p.m., May 27, 6904D, AP. From the New England AP ticker, 11:22 p.m., Chamberlain, Maine, AP. A tremendous explosion has rocked Thomas Ewan Consolidated High School in the small Maine town of Chamberlain. Three Chamberlain fire trucks dispatched earlier to fight a blaze at the gymnasium where a school prom was taking place have arrived to no avail. All fire hydrants in the area have been vandalized, and water pressure from city mains in the area from Spring Street to Grass Plaza is reported to be nil. One fire official said, "The damn things were stripped of their nozzles. They must have spouted like gushers while those kids were burning." Three bodies have been recovered so far. One has been identified as Thomas B. Mears, a Chamberlain fireman. The two others were apparent prom-goers. Three more Chamberlain firemen have been taken to Motton Receiving Hospital, suffering from minor burns and smoke inhalation. It is believed that the explosion occurred when the fire reached the school's fuel oil tanks, which are situated near the gymnasium. The fire itself is believed to have started in poorly insulated electrical equipment following a sprinkler system malfunction. Ends. 11:22 p.m., May 27, 70119E, AP. Sue had only a driver's permit, but she took the keys to her mother's car from the pegboard beside the refrigerator and ran to the garage. The kitchen clock read exactly 11 o'clock. She flooded the car on her first try and forced herself to wait before trying again. This time the motor coughed and caught, and she roared out of the garage heedlessly, dinging one fender. She turned around, and the rear wheel splurted gravel. Her mother's 77 Plymouth swerved onto the road, almost fishtailing onto the shoulder and making her feel sick to her stomach. It was only at this point that she realized she was moaning deep in her throat like an animal in a trap. She did not pause at the stop sign that marked the intersection of Route 6 and the back Chamberlain Road. Fire sirens filled the night in the east where Chamberlain bordered Westover, and from the south behind her, Motton. She was almost at the base of the hill when the school exploded. She jammed on the power brakes with both feet and was thrown into the steering wheel like a rag doll. The tires wailed on the pavement. Somehow she fumbled the door open and was out, shading her eyes against the glare. A gout of flame had ripped skyward, trailing a nimbus of fluttering steel roof panels, wood, and paper. The smell was thick and oily. Main Street was lit as if by a flash gun. In that terrible hallway between seconds, she saw that the entire gymnasium wing of Ewan High was a gutted, flaming ruin. Concussion struck a moment later, knocking her backward. Road litter blew past her in a sudden and tremendous rush, along with a blast of warm air that reminded her fleetingly of the smell of subways, a trip she had taken to Boston the year before. The windows of Bill's Home Drugstore and the Kelly Fruit Company jingled and fell inward. She had fallen on her side, and the fire lit the street with hellish noonday. What happened next happened in slow motion as her mind ran steadily onward. Dead. Are they all dead? Carrie, why think Carrie? At its own clip, cars were rushing toward the scene, and some people were running in robes, nightshirts, pajamas. She saw a man come out of the front door of Chamberlain's combined police station and courthouse. He was moving slowly. The cars were moving slowly. Even the people running were moving slowly. She saw the man on the police station steps cup his hand around his mouth and scream something. Unclear over the shrieking town whistle, the fire sirens, the monster mouth of the fire, sounded like, "Hey, Rhett, don't hey that ass!" The street was all wet down there. The light danced on the water, down by Teddy's Amoco station. "Hey, that's..." And then the world exploded. From the sworn testimony of Thomas K. Quillen, taken before the State Investigatory Board of Maine in connection with the events of May 27-28 in Chamberlain, Maine. Abridged version which follows is from Black Prom, the White Commission Report, Signet Books, New York, 1980. Question, Mr. Quillen, are you a resident of Chamberlain? Answer, yes. Question, what is your address? Answer, I got a room over the pool hall. That's where I work. I mop the floors, vacuum the tables, work on the machines, pinball machines, you know. Question, where were you on the night of May 27th at 10:30 p.m., Mr. Quillen? Answer, well, actually, I was in a detention cell at the police station. I get paid on Thursday, see, and always go out and get bombed. I go out to the Cavalier, drink some Schlitz, play a little poker out back, but I get mean when I drink. Feels like the roller derby's going on in my head. Bummer, huh? Once I conked a guy over the head with a chair and... Question, was it your habit to go to the police station when you felt these fits of temper coming on? Answer, yeah, Big Otis, he's a friend of mine. Question, are you referring to Sheriff Otis Doyle of this county? Answer, yeah, he told me to pop in any time I started feeling mean. The night before the prom, a bunch of us guys were in the back room down at the Cavalier playing stud poker, and I got to thinking, Fast Marcel Dubay was cheating. I would have known better sober. A Frenchman's idea of pulling a fast one is to look at his own cards. But that got me going. I'd had a couple of beers, you know, so I folded my hand and went on down to the station. Plessy was catching, and he locked me right up in holding cell number one. Plessy's a good boy. I knew his mom, but that was many years ago. Question. Mr. Quillen, do you suppose we could discuss the night of the 27th? 10:30 p.m. Answer, ain't we? Question, I devoutly hope so. Continue. Answer, well, Plessy locked me up around 1:45 on Friday morning, and I popped right off to sleep. Passed out, you might say. Woke up around 4:00 the next afternoon, took 3 Alka-Seltzers, and went back to sleep. I got a knack that way. I can sleep till my hangover's all gone. Big Otis says I should find out how I do it and take out a patent. He says I could save the world a lot of pain. Question, I'm sure you could, Mr. Quillen. Now, when did you wake up again? Answer, around 10:00 on Friday night. I was pretty hungry, so I decided to go get some chow down at the diner. Question, they left you all alone in an open cell? Answer, sure. I'm a fantastic guy when I'm sober. In fact, one time... Question, just tell the committee what happened when you left the cell. Answer, the fire whistle went off, that's what happened. Scared the bejesus out of me. I ain't heard that whistle at night since the Vietnam War ended. So I ran upstairs, and son of a bitch, there's no one in the office. I say to myself, hot damn, Plessy's gonna get it for this. There's always supposed to be somebody catching, in case there's a call-in. So I went over to the window and looked out. Question, could the school be seen from the window? Answer, sure. It's on the other side of the street, a block and a half down. People were running around and yelling, and that's when I saw Carrie White. Question, had you ever seen Carrie White before? Answer, nope. Question, then how did you know it was she? Answer, that's hard to explain. Question, could you see her clearly? Answer, she was standing under a street light by the fire hydrant on the corner of Main and Spring. Question, did something happen? Answer, I guess to Christ, the whole top of the hydrant exploded off 3 different ways, left, right, and straight up to heaven. Question, What time did this malfunction occur? Answer, around 20 to 11. Couldn't have been no later. Question, what happened then? Answer, she started downtown. Mister, she looked awful. She was wearing some kind of party dress, what was left of it, and she was all wet from that hydrant and covered with blood. She looked like she just crawled out of a car accident, but she was grinning. I never saw such a grin. It was like a death's head. She kept looking at her hands and rubbing them on her dress, trying to get the blood off, and thinking she'd never get it off, and how she was going to pour blood on the whole town and make 'em pay. It was awful stuff. Question, how would you have any idea what she was thinking? Answer, I don't know. I can't explain. Question, for the remainder of your testimony, I wish you would stick to what you saw, Mr. Quillen. Answer, okay. There was a hydrant on the corner of Grass Plaza, and that one went too. I could see that one better. The big lug nuts on the sides were unscrewing themselves. I saw that happening. It blew, just like the other one. And she was happy. She was saying to herself, that'll give 'em a shower, that'll... Whoops, sorry. The fire truck started to go by then, and I lost track of her. The new pumper pulled up to the school, and they started on those hydrants and saw they wasn't going to get no water. Chief Burton was hollering at 'em, and that's when the school exploded. Jesus. Question. Did you leave the police station? Answer. Yeah. I wanted to find Plessy and tell him about that crazy broad and the fire hydrants. I glanced over at Teddy's Amico, and I seen something that made my blood run cold. All six gas pumps was off their hooks. Teddy DeChamp's been dead since 1968, God love him, but his boy locked those pumps up every night, just like Teddy himself used to do. Every one of them Yale padlocks was hanging busted by their hasps. The nozzles were laying on the tarmac, and the automatic feeds were set on every one. Gas was pouring out onto the sidewalk and into the street. Holy Mother of God, when I seen that, my balls drew right up. Then I saw this guy running along with a lighted cigarette. Question, what did you do? Answer, hollered at him. Something like, hey, watch that cigarette. Hey, don't, that's gas. He never heard me. Fire sirens and town whistle and cars rip-assing up and down the street, I don't wonder. I saw he was going to pitch it, so I started to duck back inside. Question, what happened next? Answer, next? Why, next thing, the devil came to Chamberlain.
When the buckets fell, she was at first only aware of a loud metallic clang cutting through the music, and then she was deluged in warmth and wetness. She closed her eyes instinctively. There was a grunt from beside her, and in the part of her mind that had come so recently awake, she sensed brief pain. Tommy. The music came to a crashing, discordant halt, a few voices hanging on after it like broken strings, and in the sudden deadness of anticipation, filling the gap between event and realization, like doom, she heard someone say quite clearly, "My God, that's blood." A moment later, as if to ram the truth of it home, to make it utterly and exactly clear, someone screamed. Carrie sat with her eyes closed and felt the black bulge of terror rising in her mind. Mama had been right, after all. They had taken her again, gulled her again, made her the butt again. The horror of it should have been monotonous, but it was not. They had gotten her up here in front of the whole school, and had repeated the shower room scene. Only the voice had said, "My God, that's blood." Something too awful to be contemplated. If she opened her eyes, and it was true, oh, what then? What then? Someone began to laugh, a solitary, affrighted hyena sound, And she did open her eyes, open them to see who it was. And it was true. The final nightmare. She was red and dripping with it. They had drenched her in the very secretness of blood. In front of all of them, and her thought, "Oh, I covered with it," was colored a ghastly purple with her revulsion and her shame. She could smell herself, and it was the stink of blood, the awful, wet, coppery smell. In a flickering kaleidoscope of images, she saw the blood running thickly down her naked thighs, heard the constant beating of the shower on the tiles, felt the soft patter of tampons and napkins against her skin as voices exhorted her to plug it up, tasted the plump, fulsome bitterness of horror. They had finally given her the shower they wanted. A second voice joined the first, and she was followed by a third, girl's soprano giggle, a fourth, a fifth, six, a dozen, all of them, all laughing. Vic Mooney was laughing. She could see him. His face was utterly frozen, shocked, but that laughter issued forth just the same. She sat quite still, letting the noise wash over her like surf. They were still all beautiful, and there was still enchantment and wonder. But she had crossed a line, and now the fairy tale was green with corruption and evil. In this one she would bite a poison apple, be attacked by trolls, be eaten by tigers. They were laughing at her again. And suddenly it broke. The horrible realization of how badly she had been cheated came over her. And a horrible, soundless cry, "They're looking at me," tried to come out of her. She put her hands over her face to hide it and staggered out of the chair. Her only thought was to run, to get out of the light, to let the darkness have her and hide her. But it was like trying to run through molasses. Her traitor mind had slowed time to a crawl. It was as if God had switched the whole scene from 78 RPM to 33 and a third. Even the laughter seemed to have deepened and slowed to a sinister bass rumble. Her feet tangled in each other, and she almost fell off the edge of the stage. She recovered herself, bent down, and hopped down to the floor. The grinding laughter swelled louder. It was like rocks rubbing together. She wanted not to see, but she did see. The lights were too bright, and she could see all their faces, their mouths, their teeth, their eyes. She could see her own gore-streaked hands in front of her face. Miss Desjardins was running toward her, and Miss Desjardins' face was filled with lying compassion. Carrie could see beneath the surface to where the real Miss Desjardins was giggling and chuckling with rancid old-maid ribaldry. Miss Desjardins' mouth opened, and her voice issued forth, horrible and slow and deep. "Let me help you, dear. Oh, I am so sorry." She struck out at her. "Flex." And Miss Desjardins went flying to rattle off the wall at the side of the stage and fall into a heap. Carrie ran. She ran through the middle of them. Her hands were to her face, but she could see through the prison of her fingers, could see them, how they were, beautiful, wrapped in light, swathed in the bright, angelic robes of acceptance. The shined shoes, the clear faces, the careful beauty parlor hairdos, the glittery gowns. They stepped back from her as if she was plague, but they kept laughing. Then a foot was stuck slyly out. Oh, yes, that comes next. Oh, yes. And she fell on her hands and knees and began to crawl. To crawl along the floor with her blood-clotted hair hanging in her face, crawling like St. Paul on the Damascus Road, whose eyes had been blinded by the light. Next, someone would kick her ass. But no one did. And then she was scrabbling to her feet again.
Things began to speed up. She was out through the door, out into the lobby, then flying down the stairs that she and Tommy had swept up so grandly 2 hours ago. Tommy's dead. Full price paid. Full price for bringing a plague into the place of light. She went down them in great, awkward leaps, with the sound of the laughter flapping around her like blackbirds. Then, darkness. She fled across the school's wide front lawn, losing both of her prom slippers and fleeing barefoot. The closely cut school lawn was like velvet, lightly dusted with dewfall, and the laughter was behind her. She began to calm slightly. Then her feet did tangle, and she fell at full length out by the flagpole. She lay quiescent, breathing raggedly, her hot face buried in the cool grass. The tears of shame began to flow, as hot and as heavy as that first flow of menstrual blood had been. They had beaten her, bested her, once and for all time. It was over. She would pick herself up very soon now and sneak home by the back streets, keeping to the shadows in case someone came looking for her, find Mama, admit she had been wrong. No. The steel in her, and there was a great deal of it, suddenly rose up and cried the word out strongly. The closet? The endless wandering prayers, the tracks and the cross, and only the mechanical bird and the Black Forest cuckoo clock to mark off the rest of the hours and days and years and decades of her life? Suddenly, as if a videotape machine had been turned on in her mind, she saw Miss Desjardins running toward her and saw her thrown out of her way like a rag doll, as she used her mind on her, without even consciously thinking of it. She rolled over on her back, eyes staring wildly at the stars from her painted face. She was forgetting the power. It was time to teach them a lesson, time to show them a thing or two. She giggled hysterically. It was one of Mama's pet phrases. Mama coming home, putting her purse down, eyeglasses flashing. Well, I guess I showed that elf a thing or two at the shop today. There was the sprinkler system. She could turn it on easily. She giggled again and got up, began to walk barefoot back toward the lobby doors. Turn on the sprinkler system and close all the doors. Look in and let them see her looking in, watching and laughing, while the shower ruined their dresses and their hairdos and took the shine off their shoes. Her only regret was that it couldn't be blood. The lobby was empty. She paused halfway up the stairs, and flex, the doors all slammed shut under the concentrated force she directed at them, the pneumatic door closers snapping off. She heard some of them scream, and it was music. Sweet soul music. For a moment, nothing changed, and then she could feel them pushing against the doors, wanting them to open. The pressure was negligible. They were trapped. Trapped. And the word echoed intoxicatingly in her mind. They were under her thumb. In her power. Power. What a word that was. She went the rest of the way up and looked in, and George Dawson was smashed up against the glass, struggling, pushing, his face distorted with effort. There were others behind him, and they all looked like fish in an aquarium. She glanced up, and yes, there were the sprinkler pipes with their tiny nozzles like metal daisies. The pipes went through small holes in the green cinder block wall. There was a great many inside, she remembered. Fire laws or something. Fire laws. In a flash, her mind recalled. Black, thick cords like snakes. the power cords strung all over the stage. They were out of the audience's sight, hidden by the footlights, but she had had to step carefully over them to get to the throne. Tommy had been holding her arm. Fire and water. She reached up with her mind, felt the pipes, traced them. Cold, full of water. She tasted iron in her mouth. Cold, wet metal. The taste of water drunk from the nozzle of a garden hose. Flex. For a moment, nothing happened. Then they began to back away from the doors, looking around. She walked to the small oblong of glass in the middle door and looked inside. It was raining in the gym. Carrie began to smile. She hadn't gotten all of them, only some. But she found that by looking up at the sprinkler system with her eyes, she could trace its course more easily with her mind. She began to turn on more of the nozzles, and more. Yet it wasn't enough. They weren't crying yet, so it wasn't enough. Hurt them, then. Hurt them. There was a boy up on stage by Tommy, gesturing wildly and shouting something. As she watched, he climbed down and ran toward the rock band's equipment. He caught hold of one of the microphone stands and was transfixed. Carrie watched, amazed, as his body went through a nearly motionless dance of electricity. His feet shuffled in the water, his hair stood up in spikes, and his mouth jerked open like the mouth of a fish. He looked funny. She began to laugh. By Christ, then, let them all look funny. And in a sudden blind thrust, she yanked at all the power she could feel. Some of the lights puffed out. There was a dazzling flash somewhere as a live power cord hit a puddle of water. There were dull thumps in her mind as circuit breakers went into hopeless operation. The boy who had been holding the mic stand fell over on one of his amps, and there was an explosion of purple sparks, and then the crepe bunting that faced the stage was burning. Just below the thrones, a live 220-volt electricity cable was crackling on the floor, and beside it, Rhonda Simmerd was doing a crazed puppet dance in her green tulle formal. Its full skirt suddenly blazed into flame, and she fell forward, still jerking. It might have been at that moment that Carrie went over the edge. She leaned against the doors, her heart pumping wildly, yet her body as cold as ice cubes. Her face was livid, but dull red fever spots stood on each cheek. Her head throbbed thickly, and conscious thought was lost. She reeled away from the door, still holding them shut, doing it without thought or plan. Inside, the fire was brightening, and she realized dimly that the mural must have caught on fire. She collapsed on the top step and put her head down on her knees, trying to slow her breathing. They were trying to get out the doors again, but she held them shut easily. That alone was no strain. Some obscure sense told her that a few were getting out the fire doors, but let them. She would get them later. She would get all of them. Every last one. She went down the stairs slowly and out the front doors, still holding the gymnasium doors closed. It was easy. All you had to do was see them in your mind. The town whistle went off suddenly, making her scream and put her hands in front of her face. The whistle. It's just the fire whistle. For a moment, her mind's eye lost sight of the gymnasium doors, and some of them almost got out. No. No. Naughty. She slammed them shut again, catching somebody's fingers. It felt like Dale Norbert in the jam and severing one of them. She began to reel across the lawn again, a scarecrow figure with bulging eyes, toward Main Street. On her right was downtown, the department store, the Kelly Fruit, the beauty parlor and barber shop, gas stations, police station, fire station. They'll put out my fire. But they wouldn't. She began to giggle, and it was an insane sound. Triumphant, lost, victorious, terrified. She came to the first hydrant and tried to twist the huge painted lug nut on the side. Ooh! It was heavy. It was very heavy. Metal twisted tight to balk her. Didn't matter. She twisted harder and felt it give. Then the other side. Then the top. Then she twisted all three at once, standing back, and they unscrewed in a flash. Water exploded outward and upward, one of the lug nuts flying 5 feet in front of her at suicidal speed. It hit the street, caromed high into the air, and was gone. Water gushed with white pressure in a cruciform pattern. Smiling, staggering, her heart beating at over 200 per minute, she began to walk down toward Grass Plaza. She was unaware that she was scrubbing her bloodied hands against a dress like Lady Macbeth, or that she was weeping even as she laughed, or that one hidden part of her mind was keening over her final and utter ruin. Because she was going to take them with her, and there was going to be a great burning, until the land was full of its stink. She opened the hydrant at Grass Plaza, and then began to walk down to Teddy's Amoco. It happened to be the first gas station she came to, but it was not the last. From the sworn testimony of Sheriff Otis Doyle, taken before the State Investigatory Board of Maine, from the White Commission report, pages 29 through 31. Question, Sheriff, where were you on the night of May 27th? Answer, I was on Route 179, known as Old Benton Road, investigating an automobile accident. This was actually over the Chamberlain Town line and into Durham, but I was assisting Mel Crager, who is the Durham constable. Question, when were you first informed that trouble had broken out at Ewan High School? Answer, I received a radio transmission from Officer Jacob Plessy at 10:21. Question, what was the nature of the radio call? Answer, Officer Plessy said there was trouble at the school, but he didn't know if it was serious or not. There was a lot of shouting going on, he said, and someone had pulled a couple of fire alarms. He said he was going over to try and determine the nature of the trouble. Question, did he say the school was on fire? Answer, no, sir. Question, did you ask him to report back to you? Answer, I did. Question, did Officer Plessy report back? Answer, no. He was killed in the subsequent explosion of Teddy's Amoco gas station on the corner of Main and Summer. Question, when did you next have a radio communication concerning Chamberlain? Answer, at 10:42. I was at that time returning to Chamberlain with a suspect in the back of my car, a drunk driver. As I have said, the case was actually in Mel Crager's town, but Durham has no jail. When I got him to Chamberlain, we didn't have much of one either. Question, what communication did you receive at 10:42? Answer, I got a call from the state police that had been relayed from the Mottin Fire Department. The state police dispatcher said there was a fire and an apparent riot at Ewan High School and a probable explosion. No one was sure of anything at that time. Remember, it all happened in a space of 40 minutes. Question, we understand that, Sheriff. What happened then? Answer, I drove back to Chamberlain with Siren and Flasher. I was trying to raise Jake Plessy and not having any luck. That's when Tom Quillen came on and started to babble about the whole town going up in flames and no water. Question, do you know what time that was? Answer, yes, sir. I was keeping a record by then.
It was 10:58. Question. Quillen claims the Amoco station exploded at 11 o'clock.
Answer.
I'd take the average, sir. Call it 10:59.
Question.
At what time did you arrive in Chamberlain?
Answer.
At 11:10 p.m.
Question.
What was your immediate impression upon arriving, Sheriff Doyle?
Answer.
I was stunned. I couldn't believe what I was seeing.
Question.
What exactly were you seeing?
Answer.
The entire upper half of the town's business section was burning. The Amoco station was gone. Woolworth's was nothing but a blazing frame. The fire had spread to 3 wooden storefronts next to that. Duffy's Bar and Grill, the Kelly Fruit Company, and the billiard parlor. The heat was ferocious. Sparks were flying onto the roofs of the Maitland Real Estate Agency and Doug Brand's Western Auto Store. Fire trucks were coming in, but they could do very little. Every fire hydrant on that side of the street was stripped. The only trucks doing any business at all were 2 old volunteer fire department pumpers from Westover, and about all they could do was wet the roofs of the surrounding buildings. And, of course, the high school, it was just gone. Of course, it's fairly isolated. Nothing close enough to it to burn. But, my God, all those kids inside. All those kids.
Question. Did you meet Susan Snell upon entering town?
Answer. Yes, sir. She flagged me down.
Question. What time was this?
Answer.
Just as I entered town. 11:12, no later.
Question. What did she say?
Answer.
She was distraught. She'd been in a minor car accident, skidding, and she was barely making sense. She asked me if Tommy was dead. I asked her who Tommy was, but she didn't answer. She asked me if we had caught Carrie yet.
Question. The commission is extremely interested in this part of your testimony, Sheriff Doyle.
Answer. Yes, sir. I know that.
Question. How did you respond to her question?
Answer. Well, there's only one Carrie in town as far as I know, and that's Margaret White's daughter. I asked her if Carrie had something to do with the fires. Miss Snell told me Carrie had done it. Those were her words. Carrie did it. Carrie did it. She said it twice.
Question. Did she say anything else?
Answer.
Yes, sir.
She said, they've hurt Carrie for the last time.
Question. Sheriff, are you sure she didn't say, we've hurt Carrie for the last time?
Answer. I am quite sure.
Question. Are you positive?
100%?
Answer.
Sir, the town was burning around our heads. Question. Had she been drinking?
Answer. I beg pardon?
Question.
Had she been drinking? You said she had been involved in a car smash.
Answer. I believe I said a minor skidding accident.
Question. And you can't be sure she didn't say we instead of they?
Answer. I guess she might have, but...
Question. What did Miss Snell do then?
Answer.
She burst into tears.
I slapped her.
Question. Why did you do that?
Answer.
She seemed hysterical.
Question. Did she quiet eventually?
Answer.
Yes, sir.
She quieted down and got control of herself pretty well, in light of the fact that her boyfriend was probably dead.
Question. Did you interrogate her?
Answer.
Well, not the way you'd interrogate a criminal, if that's what you mean. I asked her if she knew anything about what had happened. She repeated what she had already said, but in a calmer way. I asked her where she had been when the trouble began, and she told me that she had been at home.
Question. Did you interrogate her further?
Answer.
No, sir.
Question. Did she say anything else to you? Answer, yes, sir. She asked me, begged me, to find Carrie White.
Question, what was your reaction to that?
Answer, I told her to go home.
Question, thank you, Sheriff Doyle.
Vic Mooney lurched out of the shadows near the Bankers Trust drive-in office with a grin on his face. It was a huge and awful grin, a Cheshire cat grin, floating dreamily in the fire-shot darkness like a trace memory of lunacy. His hair, carefully slicked down for his MC duties, was now sticking up in a crow's nest. Tiny drops of blood were branded across his forehead from some unremembered fall in his mad flight from the spring ball. One eye was swelled purple and screwed shut. He walked into Sheriff Doyle's squad car, bounced back like a pool ball, and grinned in at the drunk driver dozing in the back. Then he turned to Doyle, who had just finished with Sue Snell. The fire cast wavering shadows of light across everything, turning the world into the maroon tones of dried blood. As Doyle turned, Vic Mooney clutched him. He clutched Doyle as an amorous swain might clutch his lady in a hug dance. He clutched Doyle with both arms and squeezed him, all the while goggling upward into Doyle's face with his great, crazed grin. "Vic," Doyle began. "She pulled all the plugs," Vic said lightly, grinning. "Pulled all the plugs and turned on the water and buzz, buzz, buzz." "Vic, we can't let him." "Oh, no, 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 we can't. Carrie pulled all the plugs. Rhonda simmered, burn up. Oh, Jesus!" Doyle slapped him twice, calloused palm cracking flatly on the boy's face. The scream died with shocking suddenness, but the grin remained, like an echo of evil. It was loose and terrible. "What happened?" Doyle said roughly. "What happened at the school?"
"Carrie," Vic muttered. "Carrie happened at the school. She..."
He trailed off and grinned at the ground. Doyle gave him three brisk shakes. Vic's teeth clicked together like castanets.
"What about Carrie?"
"Queen of the prom," Vic muttered. "They dumped blood on her and Tommy." "What?" It was 11:15. Tony's sit-go on Summers suddenly exploded with a great coughing roar. The street went daylight that made them both stagger back against the police car and shield their eyes. A huge, oily cloud of fire climbed over the elms in Courthouse Park, lighting the duck pond and the Little League diamond in scarlet. Amid the hungry, crackling roar that followed, Doyle could hear glass and wood and hunks of gas station cinder block rattling back to earth. A secondary explosion followed, making them wince again. He still couldn't get it straight. "My town. This is happening in my town." That this was happening in Chamberlain. In Chamberlain, for God's sake, where he drank iced tea on his mother's sun porch and refereed PAL basketball and made one last cruise out Route 6 past the Cavalier before turning up at 2:30 every morning. His town was burning up. Tom Quillen came out of the police station and ran down the sidewalk to Doyle's cruiser. His hair was standing up every which way. He was dressed in dirty green work fatigues and an undershirt, and he had his loafers on the wrong feet. But Doyle thought he had never been so glad to see anyone in his life. Tom Quillen was as much Chamberlain as anything, and he was here, intact.
"Holy God," he panted. "Did you see that?" "What's been happening?" Doyle asked curtly.
"I've been monitoring the radio," Quillen said. "Motten and Westover wanted to know if they should send ambulances, and I said, hell yes, send everything. Hearses, too. Did I do right?"
"Yes." Doyle ran his hands through his hair. "Have you seen Harry Block?" Block was the town's commissioner of public utilities, and that included water.
"Nope. But Chief Dan says they got water in the old rennet block across town. They're laying hose now. I collared some kids, and they're setting up a hospital in the police station. They're good boys, but they're going to get blood on your floor, Otis. Otis Doyle felt unreality surge over him. Surely this conversation